This source material is an academic white paper titled From Consumption to Communion, which proposes that the Eucharist reveals an anti-predatory ontology that directly counters the extractive, destructive systems of modern civilization. I can see what you're going for here. Let's see how we can strengthen this.
Yeah, and before we dive into the specific structural edits, I just have to say how fascinating the foundational premise of this paper is. Usually when we talk about a biological diet, there's this expectation of, you know, simple mechanics.
Right, like calories in, calories out.
Exactly. You consume calories, your body burns them for energy, and, well, you move on. It's an entirely transactional process.
Fuel in the tank. It's clean, it's mathematical.
Right. We generally like our biology to be a closed loop that we can easily measure. But what this paper does is it takes the realm of theology, intersects it with systemic sociology, and suddenly that closed loop just bursts wide open. We're looking at a metabolic landscape that is honestly cosmic.
It is the absolute definition of existential digestion. And navigating that massive conceptual landscape requires a very deliberate structure, which brings us to the first major area of focus for our author today, the transition from the theological exposition to real-world systemic application currently feels somewhat abrupt, potentially diluting the impact of the civilizational critique.
I completely agree. As I understand it from the notes, the argument here is structured quite sequentially.
Yeah, very linear.
Right, so sections 2 through 4 focus heavily on the theological exegesis of John 6, diving deep into the scandal of flesh and blood, the refusal of disembodied religion, and the concept of total self-gift.
Which is heavy, dense material on its own.
Oh, incredibly dense. And then it isn't really until section 5 that the paper deeply engages with the sociological and systemic concepts. It starts bringing in things like institutional autopoiesis, you know, Maturana and Varela, and McMurtry's money sequence system.
Yeah, keeping the ancient theology and the modern sociological critique in completely separate silos creates a surprisingly disjointed reading experience.
It really does. The reader is essentially being asked to hold this massive, complex theological scaffolding in their mind for pages and pages before they get to see how it actually applies to modern systems.
And I want to pause you right there, because as a reader, when I hit section 5, I felt that disconnect intensely. You mentioned autopoiesis, Maturana and Varela, and McMurtry.
Yeah, the 1970s systems biology stuff.
Exactly. For the listener, and frankly for me, who might be a little rusty on dense economic theory, how exactly does that biological concept map onto a modern bureaucracy? If we don't unpack that jargon right now, the gap feels even wider.
That is a crucial point to clarify, and it's exactly why the text needs restructuring. So, autopoiesis was originally a concept coined by biologists Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela.
Okay.
It describes how a system like a single biological cell continually reproduces its own parts to maintain its survival. It's a closed, self-sustaining, self-referential loop.
So it just feeds itself to keep being itself.
Exactly. And what the author is doing in section 5 is applying that cellular biology to human institutions.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The argument is that a modern bureaucracy, like, say, a massive healthcare conglomerate or a financial institution, eventually stops existing to serve its original human purpose. Instead, it starts acting like a giant, hungry cell.
Just eating everything around it.
Yeah. It consumes resources, labor, and human lives merely to sustain its own architecture and ensure its own survival.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. It essentially eats its surroundings to stay alive. The institution becomes the apex predator.
Yes, and the fundamental weakness of the current draft is that you have this visceral, almost terrifying concept of institutional flesh-eating sitting way out on page 15.
Right.
And it's entirely divorced from the visceral, ancient taboo of consuming flesh that the author covers way back on page 4 in the biblical exegesis of John 6.
Yeah, it's like building two halves of a massive bridge and hoping the reader trusts they will somehow magically connect in the middle. We need to lay the theological and systemic planks simultaneously.
Exactly.
Because if we don't, the reader might just stand on the theology side, admiring the historical view, but never actually crossing over to the civilizational critique.
So the suggestion to fix this is to braid the sociological concepts into the theological exposition much earlier in the text. We want to collapse that distance.
Right. Bring them together.
Yeah, we need the reader to see the immediate relevance of the ancient text to the systems they literally live inside today.
But wait, doesn't throwing modern institutional critique into an ancient theological exegesis risk giving the reader, I don't know, mental whiplash?
I mean, it can, if it's clumsy.
Because I know as an author, it's incredibly tempting to keep all your theology pure in one section, establishing the historical context and linguistic roots before muddying the waters with critiques of modern capitalism. How do we transition between ancient Palestine and a modern hospital bureaucracy smoothly without breaking the academic tone?
You do it by linking the core mechanism of consumption, not just the terminology. Take Figure 1, the two metabolisms framework.
Oh, yeah, that chart is fantastic.
It's a brilliant synthesis of these ideas, but it's currently introduced much later in the document. Let's move key elements of that framework right into Section 2.
Okay, so pull it way forward.
Right.
When the text introduces the scandalous concept of the destructive eaters of flesh from the biblical text, use that exact paragraph to project the metaphor forward.
Show me how that looks on the page. Like, mechanically.
Okay, so you write the historical exegesis, but then you pivot within the same section. You state, this ancient taboo is not merely a historical artifact. It is the operating system of modern autopoiesis.
Oh, I like that sentence.
Thanks. And then you drop a massive anchor for the reader. You briefly show exactly how a hospital system, an institution designed for healing, can undergo autopoiesis and begin consuming its patients and medical staff.
Yeah.
You detail how billing metrics and patient throughput force a doctor to treat a human being as extractable data.
So you put the ancient gnawing on flesh side by side with the modern bureaucracy gnawing on human vulnerability?
Exactly. You detail how a system built to sustain life ends up feeding on it. By braiding them together, the exegesis of John 6 instantly becomes a critique of modern predatory capitalism and institutional survival.
You don't have to wait until page 14 to realize the paper is actually talking about the world we live in right now.
Right.
That makes the ancient text instantly terrifying and profoundly relevant. It proves that the theology isn't just a metaphor, it's an active diagnostic tool.
Yeah, it grounds it completely.
Yeah, and I think that brings us beautifully to the second major area of focus for this piece. So a key theme running through this material seems to be moving the reader from diagnosis to cure. Once we've woven that systemic critique into the theology earlier on, it brings us to the final vision the paper proposes for a new civilization. The proposed vision for a Eucharistic civilization is beautifully articulated, yet it risks remaining overly abstract for practitioners seeking to implement these ideas. Let's look closely at the section discussing toward a Eucharistic civilization.
Yeah, that's section 9. The vision there is stunning, but it floats. It gives us the horizon, but not, you know, the mechanical pathways for the transition.
Right, it's very theoretical.
We have these sweeping ideals, like economic as nourishment, power as service, knowledge as participation. The headings alone are evocative, but the weakness is that while it outlines the what of a Eucharistic civilization, it glosses over the how.
It stays in the realm of high philosophy.
Exactly. And the risk here is that the reader ends up nodding along to the theory because, I mean, who wouldn't want an economy of nourishment? But they are left completely unsure of what to actually do on Monday morning.
The classic Monday morning problem.
Right. When they walk into their corporate boardrooms, their legal offices, or their technology startups. It leaves the practitioner stranded in the abstract, admiring a beautiful idea they just cannot use.
So how do we bridge that gap?
My suggestion is to utilize the brilliant material that is actually already present in the document, specifically in Appendix A.
Oh, the diagnostic questions?
Yes. The author has drafted these incredible Eucharistic diagnostic questions, but they are currently tucked away at the very end of the paper as a sort of afterthought. We need to pull those questions forward into the main body of Section 9.
Right, to anchor the theory.
Yeah, transforming those abstract philosophical ideals into active usable frameworks.
I can certainly see the mechanical benefit of that. I wonder, though, does bringing checklists into the main text disrupt the academic philosophical tone of the paper? I mean, this is a highly elevated academic white paper. Does dropping bulleted diagnostic checklists into the climax of the argument make it feel too much like an HR manual?
I get that fear.
because I feel like as a writer, I'd be worried about ruining the prose.
It absolutely could ruin the prose if it's poorly integrated, but pulling them forward actually enhances the tone if you focus on the literary mechanics of how you embed them.
Okay, how so?
You are proving that the philosophy can withstand the friction of reality. You don't just paste a bulleted list. You embed the questions into the prose as rhetorical pivots to drive the philosophical inquiry deeper.
Give me an example of the actual writing mechanics here. How does the author format this on the page?
Let's take section 9.2, Economy as Nourishment. Instead of just stating the abstract theory that production and exchange should be subordinate to human flourishing, you use the diagnostic question to pivot the paragraph.
Right.
You state the philosophy. You pose the question as a rhetorical challenge. Could this economy be blessed at the altar without contradiction? And then you immediately answer that challenge with a brief, maybe three-sentence vignette about a specific supply chain.
Unpack that vignette for me. What are we showing the reader?
You describe the mechanical shift. You describe what it looks like when a company stops treating its agricultural inputs as mere extractable inventory and starts treating them as a shared ecology.
Oh, okay.
You explain that it means shifting away from maximizing quarterly profit margins at the expense of the local water table and moving toward a model that actually replenishes the water table, even if it means slower corporate growth.
Wow.
Yeah. When you embed the question, could this supply chain be blessed? You force the reader to picture the literal boardroom decision that aligns with the altar.
That completely changes the texture of the section. It takes it from a lofty aspiration to a measurable metric.
Let's look at another one of those headings. Section 9.6, Law as Protection.
Right, that's a great one.
The text currently talks about law protecting communion. That's a beautiful phrase, but again, what does it mean for a judge or a legislator reading this?
Exactly. We need to contrast an anti-Eucharistic law, one that protects property over life, with a specific, grounded example of a Eucharistic legal framework. Show us a restorative justice statute that actively restores right relation.
Oh, that's powerful. Describe a system that mediates between an offender and the community to rebuild trust rather than just punishing the offender to maintain state order.
Or look at property law. You could contrast an eminent domain law that prioritizes corporate development and displacement with, say, a community land trust that permanently protects generational housing.
Yes. Show the reader the actual legal architecture. By moving the diagnostic questions from the appendix to the main text and answering them with these concrete vignettes, you give the practitioner the blueprint to actually build the civilization you were writing about.
If we are going to give practitioners the tools to build the civilization, we also have to give them the tools to recognize the traps along the way. Which leads us to a part of the paper I found incredibly provocative, but maybe a bit too fleeting. The concept of the false Eucharist of modernity is one of the most compelling insights in the text, but it is currently underutilized as a framing device.
I totally agree. It's a fascinating concept that deserves much more real estate. When I read that phrase, it immediately jumped out as the core tension of the entire piece.
Yeah, looking at the text, section 5.3 briefly mentions shopping malls, digital platforms, and political rallies as counterfeit communions. It describes them as systems that gather bodies without forming mutual care. It's a great paragraph, but it passes by so quickly.
Passing thought rather than the primary antagonist of the paper.
Right, it's just a blip.
Yeah. And this idea of the false Eucharist is a brilliant analytical tool. Without expanding on why and how these false liturgies are so persuasive, the critique of the predatory order feels slightly incomplete. We need to understand the profound seduction of the predatory system, not just its brutality.
It's the difference between saying the system is bad and showing exactly how the system tricks us into thinking it's good.
Exactly. And that leads to the primary suggestion for this section. Elevate the false Eucharist concept to act as a recurring analytical mirror throughout the entire text. We need to detail exactly how modern systems deceptively mimic the Eucharistic pattern to trap human desire.
Oh, that's dark, but so true.
They don't just passively consume us. They actively offer us a dark parody of communion. Building on that point, what if we looked at it from the perspective of the digital platforms mentioned in the text?
I think we can all relate to that. I know I found myself doom-scrolling at 1 a.m., feeling completely alienated, but desperately seeking some kind of connection through a glowing rectangle.
Right, it's exhausting.
It feels like a ritual. So how do we explain the mechanics of that false liturgy using the author's own framework?
Okay, so the paper outlines the true Eucharistic pattern in section 6.5 as take, bless, break, give.
Right.
Let's apply that exact same four-step pattern to a social media algorithm to show the counterfeit in action.
Okay, I'm ready.
First it takes, but it doesn't break bread. It takes our attention, our behavioral data, our deeply human desire for connection. It harvests our need to belong.
Wow. And then it blesses it?
Second, it blesses us, but it offers a counterfeit grace in the form of validation.
Oh, like notifications.
Exactly. It gives us likes, engagement metrics, algorithmic visibility. It mimics the feeling of being chosen and seen by the community. But it's really just the system optimizing your behavioral profile.
I definitely feel that hook. You post something and wait for the dopamine hit of the blessing.
We all do.
And then how does the algorithm break us?
It breaks our focus. It fractures our shared reality into isolated, hyper-personalized echo chambers.
Yeah.
It breaks the social body into tribal fragments that can be more easily monetized because isolated, angry people are much more engaged consumers than peaceful, connected ones.
That makes so much sense. It shatters the communal body into marketable pieces. And finally, it gives.
But what does it give back? It gives back profound alienation. It gives back a curated feed of outrage and comparison. It simulates nourishment but leaves the user starving.
It's about exposing the counterfeit currency by showing exactly how the imitation works step by step, mimicking the sacred pattern. The true value of the authentic life-giving body becomes that much more apparent.
Exactly. If you don't show how good the fake is, the reader won't appreciate the urgency of the real thing.
Right.
If you elevate this false liturgy to be the central antagonist, the entire paper gains incredible narrative tension. I really want the author to see the dramatic potential here. It's no longer just a dry sociological critique of resource extraction. It's a battle of liturgies. It's the liturgy of the algorithm versus the liturgy of the altar.
That frames the civilizational choice so clearly. So to recap the three main structural and thematic takeaways we've explored today. First, we need to weave the sociological critique of autopoiesis and extractive systems directly into the theological exegesis of John 6.
Yes.
By explaining concepts like Maturana and Varela's biological loops clearly and bringing those elements together earlier, we bridge the gap between ancient texts and modern crisis, preventing the reader from getting lost in theological silos.
Second, we highly recommend pulling the diagnostic questions from Appendix A into the main body of Section 9. By embedding those questions as rhetorical pivots and adding concrete, mechanical vignettes like the supply chain shifts or the specific community land trust laws, we provide actionable pathways for practitioners trying to actually build this Eucharistic civilization.
And finally, elevate the false Eucharist concept to serve as a recurring analytical mirror. By demonstrating exactly how modern systems destructively mimic the take, bless, break, give pattern, you expose the seductive nature of the predatory order and highlight the absolute necessity of the true communion.
The depth of thought in this material is significant, and tightening these mechanical connections will make the arguments undeniable.
Absolutely. We want to concisely thank the listener for submitting this profound material. The two metabolisms framework is absolutely fascinating, and its potential to reshape how we view both theology and society is immense. We extend a warm invitation for you to apply this feedback, restructure some of these core arguments, and submit your revised work for a future critique.
I really look forward to seeing the next iteration.
You know, it brings us right back to that metabolic landscape we talked about at the beginning. If our biology isn't just a closed loop of input and output, then our civilization isn't either. The question this paper ultimately leaves us with is the most vital one of all. When we build our systems, our technologies, and our economies, are we just engineering more efficient ways to digest each other? Or are we finally learning how to set a table?